This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Our first speaker is Stephanie Ames, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Utah, Salt Lake City, where she provides care for children with critical illness and injury in the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit. Her research interests focus on the organization and delivery of healthcare to improve patient outcomes for children with complex critical illness and chronic diseases. Her presentation today is based on her study published in 2023 on disability-based discrimination in pediatrics. Please welcome our plenary speaker, Dr. Stephanie Ames.
Thank you again so much for inviting me to speak about my research. As mentioned, I'm an assistant professor at the University of Utah, and I am a pediatric intensivist, but my research interest lies in ableism in pediatric healthcare. And I'm going to be talking about that research today. I have nothing to disclose. So just a bit of an overview of my presentation today. We will begin with a review of recent literature on ableism in healthcare specifically. We will review some recent publications looking at discrimination in children with medical complexity. These children represent only one group and one perspective of children with disability, but given their medical needs, are often in contact with the healthcare system frequently, making them more likely to experience an increased exposure to discrimination. And after this brief review, we will discuss some practical advice on anti-ableist actions that I have received directly from families, as well as from a review of the literature. So to begin, just a basic definition of discrimination. Discrimination is considered a negative action or lack of consideration given to an individual or group that occurs because of a preconceived and unjustified opinion. A study of 2,000 adults published in 2020 using a measure to identify major experiences of discrimination in healthcare found that 1 in 5 adult patients reported experiencing discrimination in the healthcare system. Discrimination, marginalization, and oppression are common and have been culturally embedded and institutionalized within our society and unfortunately throughout our healthcare system. When discrimination occurs due to a person's disability, this is ableism. In other words, ableism is the privileging of people without a disability and the devaluation of disability in a society or in an individual's thoughts and actions. And ableism, like many forms of discrimination, is embedded in our society. We can find it when we look at the model of capitalism. We can find it in our educational system and segregation of disability. And we can unfortunately find it throughout our healthcare system. We find it in interpersonal interactions where implicit bias and the medical model of disability teach that disability is a problem to be cured. We also find it in institutional and community structures where ableism isn't often included in DEI efforts. It's found in deficit language throughout healthcare where we say things like she suffers from, confined to a wheelchair, and use colloquial terms like blinded by or falls on deaf ears, things like that. And so we can find it throughout our structures and policies in healthcare as well. I first became interested in understanding ableism because of patient encounters and talking with families in the pediatric ICU. It wasn't something that was taught to me in any of my training in medical school, residency, or fellowship. And the anecdotal experiences I witnessed and the descriptions of discrimination from families really triggered my interest in understanding ableism pediatric healthcare better. So when I first set out to look at the literature on this topic, I recognized that it was quite limited. Therefore, with the help of my family partner, Melissa, and several wonderful mentors, we conducted a qualitative study of families who reported experiencing discrimination in a healthcare setting because of their child's disability. And the results of our study, which I'll be presenting today throughout the rest of this talk, were eye-opening and heartbreaking. We in our study found parents describe the perceived drivers of discrimination, the manifestations, and the outcomes. Just a little bit about our study. We conducted a qualitative study using in-depth semi-structured interviews and a thematic analysis approach to inductively identify themes related to ableism. Interviews focus on exploration of discrimination through an interview guide using a stigma framework that assessed experiences with interpersonal, institutional, and systematic discrimination. All interviews were conducted via Zoom in English or Spanish, and we also administered a demographic survey. We recruited caregivers, and when I say caregivers, I mean parents or guardians, from 15 different states through Family Voices or the Children, Youth, and Special Healthcare Needs National Research Network. And these states are represented here. And the sample characteristics of the participants who participated in the interview are shown here. Okay, so to begin, I just wanted to start with the perceived drivers of discrimination. So what do parents of children with medical complexity and disability perceive as the driver of ableism in healthcare? Well, one theme that arose in our work was clinician lack of knowledge. The lack of knowledge described varied from specific lack of knowledge about a specific diagnosis and how to treat or new guidelines to more generally and more commonly knowledge about how to care for and interact with children with disability. This is a direct quote from one of our participants saying that the provider didn't have that knowledge, nor did anybody to teach her to listen to a parent. It only takes about a minute to realize if a parent knows what they're talking about. This is also shown, lack of knowledge as a driver of discrimination is also shown throughout the other literature. This study here is an evaluation of competency for complex care patients in a pediatric residency. This study published in 2022 is a study of 110 pediatric residents at Boston Children's Hospital evaluating their readiness to care for children with medical complexity. Again, medical complexity is a subgroup of patients with disability, but these patients require high contact with healthcare systems. In this study, you can see tasks related to even to care of complex children, even in PGY3s, were rated at most somewhat competent, which means that the resident felt that they would need an attending or a fellow to be available to help with the task. And if this lack of competency persists past residency, could contribute significantly to access challenges to pediatricians for children with medical complexity. This is also seen in literature of adult physicians, meaning physicians who care for adults, where training and understanding of disability likely significantly impacts patient access. In the survey of 740 adult physicians in the US, a majority reported their training and disability to be inadequate. And furthermore, only 40% of physicians reported feeling confident in their care to provide equal care to people with disability. Furthermore, a majority reported having limited to no understanding of the Americans with Disability Act, which not only prohibits discrimination, but requires entities to take proactive steps to offer equal opportunity. Parents also perceive clinician apathy as part of the what contributed to discrimination faced by their child. Families in our study described clinician disinterest in their child, acting like the patient and family were a burden to them and a bother. And this happened throughout the healthcare system, not just with clinicians, but when scheduling, when talking with insurance, things like that. And then not listening to the parents or ignoring the child completely and their healthcare needs. This quote here describes that aspect of this theme, where the family felt that the physician wouldn't take them seriously to intervene on something because he was in a wheelchair. And the survey of adult physicians, shockingly, only half physicians strongly agreed that they would welcome openly patients with disability into their practice, and one-fifth reported that the healthcare system treats patients with disability unfairly, showing continued evidence of apathy and disinterest as a driver of discrimination. The final parent perceived driver of discrimination in our study was clinician assumptions based on the child's diagnosis or assumptions based on quality of life. These assumptions are a form of implicit bias. Other examples of how implicit bias against disability can be represented include making assumptions about competence, making the assumption that disability is equal to suffering, assumptions that people with disability just want to be cured or fixed. All of these assumptions play into major assumptions regarding quality of life. In one study of adult physicians, 80% reported that patients with disability had a worse quality of life than those without. And even when we measure quality of life in most validated measures of quality of life for pediatrics and adults, they are ableist in their assumption that function is equal to high quality of life, making a lot of the literature on quality of life bias. In our study, caregivers commonly reported clinicians making assumptions about a child's quality of life because of the disability. These assumptions were perceived to be assumptions about the child's worthiness for care as well, which parents felt led to biased decision making. I think this quote really sums up what this theme in our study, where a mother stated, "I had a few remarks made by my doctor that it was inhumane basically for someone to be disabled and for you to know that you're going to support their life knowing they're going to be disabled." I think it's really critical to understand and recognize this form of bias and discrimination, because prior research has shown that clinicians are often inaccurate in their assessment of a patient's quality of life. They often report quality of life to be much lower than the patient or the caregiver reports. And this is termed the disability paradox, which is the concept of misprediction of quality of life. It represents a significant bias against disability, and in healthcare can have negative consequences, especially when assumed quality of life is conflated with futility. Next, I will move on to talk about how families perceive discrimination to occur. So we will describe the experiences or manifestations of discrimination in this population. In our study, ableism presented for families as lack of access to care, substandard patient care practices, and dehumanization of their child. So first, we'll explore lack of access to care, and sub themes that came up within this theme included provider unwillingness to welcome or provide care to patients with disability. This was echoed throughout our study, with findings occurring in primary care settings, emergency departments, and subspecialty care. Often, families felt provider lack of knowledge or interest was felt to describe these experiences, with children being denied access to a provider because of provider discomfort. Another sub thing related to the lack of access was lack of reasonable accommodations provided. Examples that occurred in our study included lack of wheelchair scales, lack of handicap parking, as well as examples of healthcare services not considering the developmental age of the child or sensory challenges when performing medical services or interventions. Finally, access to care was further exacerbated for patients from a minoritized culture, language, ethnicity, or race. In this sub-theme, families described experiences of feeling unwelcome in a practice due to race or ethnicity and provider unwillingness to provide translation services when needed. The next theme that emerged as a manifestation of discrimination was substandard care practices due to the patient's disability. This sub-theme included sub-themes of medical decisions being negatively influenced by the patient's disability and inappropriate treatments of pain. These two quotes are from our study, and they demonstrate these two themes. The first quote describes a mother with a child with developmental delay who felt that her care team would not provide therapy services such as physical, occupational, or speech therapy because they assumed he would not progress. The next sub-theme about pain in children with disability also emerged. This sub-theme encompasses experiences where pain was undertreated or not even treated at all due to assumptions of disability and painful experiences in children with both physical or cognitive disability. Inaccurate assumptions of pain in spinal cord injuries and patients with limited mobility were common in our study and also in the supporting literature. The final theme that arose in our manifestations of discrimination was dehumanization. This often presented as a lack of acknowledgement or communication with the patient. In these experiences, caregivers describe providers ignoring the patient, not looking at the patient, or not even talking to the patient at all during patient encounters. This also represented inappropriate interactions, which was most often related to physical examination, where the physician or provider skipped the exam because they weren't sure how to interact with the patient, or didn't ask for appropriate consent or talk through the exam like they would with other children. Finally, other dehumanizing events included inappropriate comments to caregivers. Examples of this included using inappropriate slang for developmental delay or disability and suggesting a child not worthy of continued care. This quote from a mother describes dehumanization. She describes here and says, "They mistreated her and treated her like a robot. Every single time a nurse walked in the room, they treated her like she was not even there." So now we have discussed the perceived drivers, manifestations, and we will move on to how this impacts patient outcomes. We know disparities, which are defined as preventable differences in the experience of a disease based on membership in a disadvantaged group, exist for people with disabilities. These have been documented in the literature and include disparities in preventative services, in treatment and diagnosis of cancer, reproductive care, general communication with healthcare workers, and overall satisfaction with care. There are key system level factors that contribute to these disparities that are explored in current research, and others that include inadequate training of healthcare professionals, lack of accommodations leading to physical access barriers, and also provider implicit bias. Implicit bias is really important to recognize because it can significantly impact communication, which impacts trust and confidence in the plan of care. They can also impact medical decision, leading to poor outcomes. And we know cognitive biases are linked to medical errors, and implicit bias, particularly in my opinion, assumptions of quality of life and worthiness that lead to decision-making for patient care, have the potential to be very harmful. However, the potential impacts of discrimination are not solely because of clinician decision-making, but also because of harm can occur because of the self-perception of the experiences. Perceived discrimination has been linked to poor health outcomes through two theorized pathways. First, the cumulative nature of stress related to perceived discrimination can directly impact physical and mental health through biological mechanisms such as heightened cardiovascular activity, accelerated cellular aging, increased cortisol, which leads to poor memory and impacts neurodevelopment. In addition, perceived discrimination can indirectly negatively affect health through modification of health behaviors, including avoidance of care. And although this figure is not specific to discrimination because of ableism, studies in adult populations have echoed these findings, showing that people with disability who experience discrimination are more likely to avoid preventative care services and report worse mental health outcomes than people with disability who have not reported experiencing discrimination. However, the outcomes in children are, which is my area of interest, are understudied. But they may be different than adults because of the difference in their healthcare systems and the influence of their parents or guardians. Parents and guardians play a key role in navigating the healthcare system for their child, however, and are therefore themselves likely to experience the discrimination and recognize the implicit bias through care interactions, as well as be able to identify key systematic barriers against their child because of structural discrimination. Therefore, in our qualitative study, we thought to explore this aspect of ableism. Our study reported discrimination, the impacts of discrimination on caregivers of children with medical complexity led to loss of trust, increased caregiver burden, and decreased well-being. And this was a cumulative disadvantage of intersecting identities and an additive effect when there were other identities involved. So the first common thing reported by families that was a result of discrimination was loss of trust in healthcare. I think this quote from a mother really summarizes the whole theory behind this. I had a lack of trust for any provider that approached me, feeling like there was just no sincerity in our wishes or the value in our son's life. Next, caregivers also reported increased burden of caregiving. In our study, parents described challenges in finding appropriate medical teams, searching for providers, particularly when their care was disrupted by discriminatory events. Parents in our study often wouldn't tolerate discrimination and would find someone else that they could trust to care adequately for their child. Caregivers described building this team and how they would often have to travel long distances for medical care when the discrimination had occurred. In addition, many caregivers described a concept of forced advocacy following experience of discrimination. In this sub-theme, families described how they would have to speak up and advocate for their child with a disability to get adequate healthcare differently than they had to advocate for their other children. And this feeling of need to increase advocacy added to their caregiving burden. The next emergent theme from this area of study was mental health care changes in caregivers. This theme incorporated both positive and negative impacts on caregivers. Many caregivers described PTSD symptoms, anxiety, depression, and a lot of feelings of guilt and personal blame that their child was treated in this way and they could do nothing to prevent it. In addition, parents described forced resiliency, where they saw the way their child was treated and then with the forced advocacy saw other resources to fight for their child's healthcare. And this process developed resiliency. The final emergent theme regarding caregiver impacts was the intersection of disability, race, and socioeconomic status. In this theme, caregivers experienced scenarios and discrimination of the care of their child, which was additive, either due to race or socioeconomic status. Common discriminatory experiences were perceived to surround the use of Medicaid and healthcare worker judgments based on this type of insurance. In addition, racial minorities in the study described challenges of advocating for their child of a different race than the clinician. This added barrier and intersection of discrimination increased the challenges of advocacy for parents and led to continued distrust and stress. So we have reviewed our study, the results of our study, including the drivers, manifestation, and some of the outcomes from ableism, knowing that there is so much still left unexplored and so much more work to do. But I wanted to end with some tips, both from parents in our study, as well as the literature about how to be anti-ableist and provide quality care to children with disability. So from our families in our study first, we asked them in our interview, what makes a good provider to you and your child? First, they said, use us as a resource and consider us part of the team. I feel empowering parents and making them feel as part of the team should be a primary goal. The parents should be involved and have a lot more credit. Next, actively show interest in the child as a person, not just a patient. Parents described providers who would ask about their child's interests, asked about what makes them happy, what they dislike, what their plans were for the summer, and how to best communicate and interact with them. Parents in our study noticed and talked about how when providers remembered detail of their child as a person, not just their health record, that made a big difference to them. And finally, be willing to learn and adapt. This quote says, the ability to think outside the box and recognize that as a provider, you're also still growing, I think is really important. Because every day we have the ability to interact with other humans that will impact our life. And I think it's really important that as providers, just because we're trained medically in therapy, dental practice, it doesn't mean that we know everything. And every patient that we care for is an individual we can learn from. In addition to these tips, we must also recognize disability as part of our diversity and work actively to be anti-ableist. We must be collaborative and be conscious of issues related to disability, including being aware of the experiences, needs, and rights of individuals with disability. We must also show disability humility. This is a term that refers to a humble and respectful attitude towards understanding of disability, acknowledging the experiences, perspectives, and challenges faced by individuals, and also acknowledging the diversity of the disability community. We must always be willing to listen, to avoid making assumptions, to respect autonomy, and promote inclusivity. Ways to do this include monitoring our language. Ableist language is a barrier to quality healthcare. We should audit language to ensure inclusivity and avoid reinforcing negative views with ableist phrases such as confined to a wheelchair or using terminology which assumes a negative view. Other things that are found in the literature include avoiding inspirational narratives and also avoid infantilizing teenagers and adolescents or young adults when speaking to them by assuming competence. Always assume competence unless directed otherwise. Finally, don't avoid the word disability. Avoiding this word has reinforced its stigma, and disability is a part of our diversity. Another way to address ableism is to promote inclusion of disability in our diversity, equity, inclusion efforts. It wasn't until September of this year that the NIH designated people with disability as a population with health disparities, and many DEI committees at universities do not consider ableism still. We should also engage in curricular reform at all education levels. Increased knowledge and interaction with people with disability during training has been shown to improve knowledge and reduce implicit bias short term. And I saw in preparing for this talk that UCSF Medical School has published on their disability and ableism curriculum, which is really fantastic. Individually, we can all assess for implicit bias in decision-making, particularly when you're making any decision based on your assumptions of the child or person's quality of life without the direct information from the child or family. It's important to recognize that you can have a disability and be healthy, and that it's not synonymous with suffering. Children with disability deserve the same standards of care as other children. In addition, appropriate documentation is critical. We should avoid negative terminology and document about disability in the patient or family's words, accurate and informed information about the person's disability. It's all information should be patient-centered and inclusive of the diversity in ways which patients may identify. This includes type of disability, autonomy with ADLs, accommodation and accommodations required, as well as preferred language surrounding disability. The other thing we can do is audit our clinical spaces for access and barriers. And the way that we can do this is simply by asking our patients and their parents if there's anything they had trouble with. So did you have any trouble in accessing our clinic today? What were the barriers? And make sure you have all the appropriate accommodations for the patient that the patient needs. And also think about representation in your imagery of clinic offices and hospitals to reflect all of the patient population. Another thing that came up in our study a few times was scheduling. Scheduling, only seeing certain types of patients on certain days created a barrier for many families in our study. Next, we need to improve communication, ensure collaborative care and appropriate accommodations. And from our study, remembering to examine all patients with disabilities as closely as we would examine any other patients. And if you are unsure how to adapt your usual exam, then explain what you are hoping to do and ask the patient or their parent for advice on how to proceed rather than skipping the examination. Also, ensure appropriate accommodations during all clinical encounters. And finally, involve people with disability and their caregivers and research and programmatic development. Firmly adhere to the Nothing About Us Without Us motto and include lived experience partners in research on their health and healthcare. Report this engagement using guidelines such as GRIP 2 and ensure appropriate representation in all sampling for studies. I just wanted to end by thanking my mentors and especially my family partner, Melissa Wardrope, and her son, Sam, who is pictured here with her permission. And that I have some reference slides that are available, I believe, in the syllabus, but thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ames, for sharing with us the powerful findings from your research and also steps on how to address ableism. So at this time, I would like to introduce Dr. Dennis Kuo to this session. Dr. Dennis Kuo is Professor of Pediatrics and Chief of the Division of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics at the University of Rochester, New York. He has a long-standing interest in comprehensive care of children with disabilities and medical complexity. He is past chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics Council on Children with Disabilities. In a recent study that he co-authored, families who participated in focus groups recommended the inclusion of humanism to meaningfully transform the currently burdensome healthcare system. Dr. Kuo will lead a discussion with Dr. Ames on ways to address disability-based discrimination. Welcome, Dr. Kuo.
Good morning, everybody. It is a real pleasure and a real privilege to be part of this presentation. Dr. Ames and Stephanie, thank you for all of the research, the advocacy, and the tools that you are presenting for us. And I wanted to actually just, kind of give a couple of contextual remarks to the research and to your presentation and for the audience. I spent a lot of my career just really trying to put a lot of what we see around us into the literature, the evidence, to really the frameworks. And a lot of what you have presented really can be contextualized in like the history of things, how things have evolved really in the last 50, 70, 80 years. And I just want to make a couple of comments on that. The first is that you had mentioned about the evidence that's within the adult literature and not yet in the children's health literature. And I think it's important to recognize that one of the biggest differences between children's health and adult health is that children's health is really about development and capacity and potential. National Academy of Sciences, I want to say about 20 years ago, had advanced a definition that's also used within Bright Futures and American Academy of Pediatrics. that it's really about how individual children or groups of children are able or unable to develop and realize their potential, satisfy their needs, and develop the capacities that allow them to interact successfully with biological, physical, and social environments. Another comment I wanted to make was that the history of disability and civil rights are completely intertwined with, and the demands for children to live in communities, to live in a natural environment, to live at home, really has been increasingly supported by laws and legislation. And a lot of the resources, supports, and infrastructure that is there really has not always been guaranteed by law, legislation, and laws. IDEA and a precursor is only 50 years old. The American Disabilities Act dates back to the early 1990s under the first Bush administration. They're codified in laws, but it's not always that way. And as we know, like decisions like Olmstead, even though they affirm the rights to receive services and live in communities, that the translation is not always there. I think it is important to recognize that this is really being framed as a human rights issue and a social justice issue. And it's about affirming the value of lives and experiences, as you have pointed out, as just came right very clearly in your research. I'm very interested in how systems generate behavior. I talk about like I'm kind of a systems person, and we don't really have a coordinated system. We have smaller systems. We have subsystems. We have a healthcare system. We have an education system. We have a disability system. We have lots of systems, and the families are the folks that are going across all the systems. So in terms of what a system really needs to be able to support the lives of children with disabilities, it's really the families that understand how it all hangs together, and they're really just put in the middle. But we know that systems generate behavior, and systems have to be grounded in values and principles. And what I'm here to really emphasize is that, Stephanie, you mentioned about how we, operate within a system. And when we talk about system change, we talk about grounding it in the values and principles and looking at the processes that really govern them. And you really talked a lot about lived experiences. I'm interested in your thoughts, just based on your research, based on what you've seen, based on, all the conversation and work that you've done. When you think about it as a system, what are the values and principles that really need to be governing our system, just based on what you've heard, what you've seen? And, the next question would be, based on your research, based on your understanding, is how do these values generate the behaviors that we need to be demonstrating as a system to be able to address human rights, to be able to address ableism, to be able to address health outcomes that we know that we see disparities?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I will admit that a lot of our research, because our interview guide started with sort of questions probing on interpersonal interactions and discrimination, then institutional or community practices, and then systematic. And because so much of it became apparent in interpersonal actions, we probed a lot down that line of thinking. But there were certainly some things that came up. And I think that for our structure to be progressive, it needs to be inclusive and understanding of individuality. So we can't assume about patients based on diagnoses or based on what the medical chart says. Being really inclusive and understanding of their specific needs is important. One thing that came up several times in our study that I understand that the structure and the system creates a lot of barriers from looking at it from a provider side, reimbursement, time.
Yeah.
I'm not an outpatient pediatrician, but I can imagine that those things, I hear that those things are a challenge to making sure that you can meet the needs of your patient when they come to your clinic. And one thing that came up in our study a lot is when parents were describing a good provider, and I didn't include this in the talk because I'm not sure about the feasibility, was that they would talk about how parents would adjust, or clinicians would adjust the time needed to spend with them, would book two appointments, or would spend more time with them. And that's not necessarily feasible in the system that we have built for healthcare for a lot of physicians. And so I think assuming that everyone can fit into a 15-minute time slot for their needs is a bit unrealistic to address all the needs they have. And then how do we address that? I'm not entirely sure. I think one thing that I think is important, one thing that I think is generally needed, is a way to measure healthcare system, ableism in healthcare systems, a general measure of patient quality or patient satisfaction with care of children or people with disability. And then if you can have a quality metric that measures experiences of ableism, mm-hmm. rather than using sort of implicit bias or other ways to measure ableism, then you can set a benchmark. And this is our benchmark and we need to improve it, and then develop sort of quality improvement or implementation science tools to restructure healthcare systems.
Yeah, and I find it, as you know, I practice in the outpatient setting. I've been there for over 20 years. And I can tell you it's entirely possible, but it's not easy. And there's a lot of advocacy and there's a lot of numbers that go through and providing additional time. And sometimes you just have to say, you know, we're just going to do it and we'll make it work. And, I typically come loaded with data and anecdotes and stories and values to any admin meetings that I have to do to be able to support my own admin colleagues, because, you know, we're all in it together. But this actually raises another issue that I think I'd like to discuss the notion of lived experiences. You know, how do we implement lived experiences? What did you hear about why lived experience is so important, and how does that get embedded in the structures and systems? And the reason I'm asking is because it came up a lot. I also think strongly that, when we talk about, let's just take the example of the 15-minute visit, right? I know that that happens because somebody built a template and somebody said, this is how much time you need to be able to generate a certain amount of revenue. And there may have been a one size fits all. Whereas we also know that there are ways to be able to, if it's revenue you're concerned about, there are other ways to generate revenue according to the amount of time. And what I ask my own team is that if you're actually doing work, then just make sure you bill for it, because we're doing the right thing, right? We're not, nobody's sitting around. So that gets me to the part of lived experience, right? And so I think lived experience, based on your research and your understanding, I'd like you to just kind of expound more on what lived experience brings to systems and structures.
I think, our job as a healthcare system, as healthcare providers, is to serve families and patients. Like, that at the basic is our job. And so when I'm providing clinical care, collaborating with the family who has lived that experience is the most important part. But when you're thinking about developing a structure or a system or doing research for any group of people, really, I think lived experience is critical, fundamental to that aspect. My experience as a physician is one side of the story. It does not include anyone else's story. And I may have more insights because I interact with children and their families on a day, but that does not mean that I know what it's like to live their life. And that is what's crucial to understanding, A, what's important to understand, what's important to study, and B, how to interpret the findings when you have them. Because everything should be contextualized within the lived experience. Yeah. And then coming up with solutions, I haven't gotten that far in my research yet, but hopefully one day, that coming up with solutions needs to be based in lived experience, because I think part of the problem of the structures is they haven't been, right? So that 15-minute time slot wasn't based in a lived experience person. It was based on what worked best for the healthcare system.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Thank you. And then there's a follow-up question to that. You mentioned about thinking outside the box. What do you think that box is that folks are referring to?
Yeah, this actually came up quite a bit in our study with complex patients or patients who were having a new problem, and just that families experiencing both people who would not think outside the box, say, you know, you have this diagnosis, this is what it is, without considering other things, or this is the limitation, we're not going to talk about this anymore, versus a physician who says, you know, I actually don't know the answer to this question. I think we should work on a solution together and start thinking about what could be done, whether it's an adaptive care plan or whether it's a new treatment or new diagnostic tool, depending on the circumstance. That's what I interpreted it as, but I'm sure that could be interpreted in a much less like egocentric, more broad structural way as well. Like we need to think about ways to improve care that are not traditional and are personalized and adaptive.
Yeah. And another thing that you had mentioned was just the intersectionality of that was brought up. How does that, can you talk a little bit more about just how the intersectionality really impacts things like access, things like the lived experiences? And, you know, do you find it additive? Do you find it exponential? Do you feel like it's something that we need to be looking at kind of separately? Because there's a lot of, my concern always about like when you look at systems is that when you think about intersectionality, you're talking really about kind of different areas of focus for disparities, for example, where folks have really done amazing work. And but at the end of the day, you know, we're talking about when we are looking at the health and wellness of, say, a child and family, you really just got to be able to put it together, you know. And in your research, when we talk about intersectionality, because this is a pretty hot topic of discussion and a very, very important one, is, you know, did folks offer specific answers of how to tie it together? Do we think it's a matter of trying to work it across the programs, or was there like some insight that you have seen where it's like, you know, we kind of really got to rethink how we address the intersectionality?
I think that's a really good and difficult question to answer. I think, so back to the beginning, so what, like, I think intersectionality is, from what I could tell from families, is critical. Like your identity as a person is an individual, and you have multiple identities. And which one is playing the biggest role in discrimination is often hard to tease out. Some things like assumptions based on quality of life seem to be more related to ableism, but certainly access barriers or needing to advocate for your child, intersectionality played a major role in ability to feel welcome in a practice and an ability to feel like you can voice your opinion and advocate for your child when needed. I think some of the stories of a family, well, insurance intersectionality in your study, I think it's really important, that sampling question of inclusivity, I think it's really important to think about that when you're doing research, oversampling patient populations who may have increased intersectional identity. And for future studies, that's definitely one of my goals, is to explore intersectionality with oversampling. And I think how those play out is probably based on the individual's identity and what's more important in that role. But because a child of a minoritized race or ethnicity has disability, they're more likely to seek healthcare more frequently than others, and therefore increase their exposure to discrimination, and whether it be from race, ethnicity, language, services was also another huge issue is another topic that deserves a lot of attention, language equity. But I think, yeah.
So we could definitely keep going. And I do want to, looking at our time allotted, I think it's a good time to get to some of the questions that are in the chat and in the Q&A. I think one thing that I'm assuming I can take, since I'm in the outpatient world, is there's a number of questions about payments and reimbursements and such, and some discussion. I have a lot of thoughts on reimbursement and payment, because as I said, that's definitely an area which I've lived. And I can give you a very standard answer, and I can give you a more nuanced answer, and I do want to touch on both. You know, the standard answer is that you have to code for time. You have to make sure that you do audits of your own billing. You have to make sure that you're using, there are time-based codes. you have to decide whether it's better to base your billing on medical complexity or base it on time. And I generally find that when it comes to our extended visits, that it's just better to base it on time. In the developmental world, particularly since we have so many of our patients with disabilities would qualify for additional assessments that if you deem it appropriate, you could also use assessment codes to be able to justify the assessments that you do. The more nuanced answer is that you really have to understand the nature of the payment system that you have. And so an example is that when you get into alternative payment models, in theory, capitation and value-based payments and incentive payments would be able to cover some of the difference, because I am not seeing as much pressure or really not seeing as much willingness to try to increase the fee for service, but folks are willing to try to do more of, like, for example, care management, care coordination codes. And in addition, that there may be programs that we built under case management that may not necessarily be in the office-based setting, but is based out of community-based settings. And that's actually where New York State, where I live and work, has chosen to put a number of its resources. And so I think that it becomes a matter of knowing where the money is going. And I would encourage you not just to make sure that you're billing for time and complexity, but also to understand like where your payers are putting their funds and be able to maximize accordingly. Because, I don't think the payers or payer colleagues are looking to put all of their case management within physician offices. And I don't know if that's necessarily the right place, because then you get a very medical centric model if you're not careful. To be able to highlight another comment that was made about having a very medical centric model. So it's definitely worth a longer conversation, but my basic answer is know where healthcare financing is going and understand that not all financing is necessarily built in a healthcare system. You have to know where all your care management money is going as well. Stephanie, can you comments?
Take another one. Address that comment about how to handle, how to handle defensiveness from colleagues when raising concerns about ableism and implicit bias. It is a challenge I will 100% recognize. And I think being aware of it is the first step, acknowledging the ableism around you. I think once I started to study this, it was so apparent how common it was and really heartbreaking. One thing that I have started to do is what's a term that's used in addressing microaggressions across the spectrum, not just with ableism, but called upstanding. And so when someone says something particularly offensive, I start with assuming the best, like assuming that they didn't mean to be derogatory. It's just sort of ingrained in our culture and society and in medical deficit language, and say, I just heard what you said, and I don't think that you meant that how it came across. And how it came across to me is like whatever they said and in whatever derogatory manner. But I think what you really mean is something like this, and try and redirect the conversation. And I find a lot of times that that is a respectful way to address it without being complicit, because it really for me personally, grates on me when I hear ableist terms or ableist conversations or deficit focused language. And I'll say, I know that's not what you, I don't think that's what you meant. So let's readdress. Sometimes it's harder, certainly in positions of power. It's like not easy to do it with your boss or someone like that. But I think with colleagues and with psychological safety, with colleagues you have psychological safety with, it's a good way to start the conversation.
I'd like to take, Stephanie, what you said and actually go towards one of the first questions, and this came from Dr. Takeyama, was when systems are biased, it can perpetuate ableism even when individuals try to practice anti-ableism to work around. Is it possible to unbias systems, or is the system so broken that we have to start from the ground up?
It's a great question.
it's a fantastic question. I think both of us should probably answer that. Let me give maybe just two quick comments, and I'll turn it back over to you. Frederick Rivara, who was one of the leads in the Focus on Pediatric Subspecialty report that came out of National Academies last year, I think had a really good quote in there I wanted to highlight. It's like, we don't have a system. We have a bunch of organizations. And I will actually use the term that a lot of our initiatives tend to be very organization-centric. I think the system that we do have is really governed by different laws, different pieces of legislation. And I think that they all have their own individual like views on things. And I think it really is important to recognize that through the research that Dr. Ames has presented today, through the laws of legislation, is that a lot of this work is really just coming out into the literature, and we still have a long way to go. I think very strongly that when you look at areas outside of healthcare, there are actually some inspirational areas of change and innovation. And what they did was that they utilized something called universal design, or just using a design framework where you really have to meet the needs of those that are within a system that's really centered on families. And that's where, in my opinion, where lived experience really has to come in. I would encourage a couple of things in that, as we really are either redesigning systems or we're breaking systems and building from the ground up. I think it is helpful to use that learned, that lived experience. You can apply frameworks of design to it because they bring in not only issues of processes and outcomes, but they bring in empathy, which is a huge part of being able to address what we need. And I actually encourage utilizing all the tools and understanding we have now about how to embed families as leaders and collaborators and partners at every level. Stephanie, over to you.
I think that my opinion is that redesigning systems that seem to perpetuate ableism, it's probably got to be twofold. So systems have to be incentivized to change, and I think ability to measure, like I mentioned earlier, ability to measure ableism is kind of key to that, to have a quality metric, or patient experience, calling to attention patient experiences with ableism through different quality surveys that hospitals pay attention to, is one way to sort of drive change. And then I still think that, you know, the individuals, the frontline providers, are the face of the organization, and their ability to enact anti-ableist work is also critical. So I think both need to change. You can't just change. I mean, I do think the structure perpetuates, but I do think a lot of the structure is so ingrained in medical education, in medical treatments, there's comments talking about diagnostic codes, like it's all ingrained in there. And that requires frontline providers to be knowledgeable and also be willing to advocate.
Let me take the first question, and Stephanie, maybe take the second question that I have on here. The first is the list of accommodations needed to support a visit looks like funding needs to administration and not made available. My answer there is that I think it's really important to be able to partner with all of our levels of administration. And I really have a couple of thoughts there. One is that this is why it's important to be able to establish values and be able to appeal to the values of the organization. And, you know, every organization has values and mission statements. I don't think anybody wants to exclude. And so they have to be able to figure out how this is priorities that meets the values and mission. The other is this is where families as leaders and collaborators and with the lived experience comes in, because I think this is absolutely important to be able to demonstrate to administrative colleagues. And I will count myself as one of the administrative colleagues, because I work at administration right now as well.
I would also be interested in, like, legally, that I would be interested from a legal perspective, how that could be made more accessible. Like, I think absolutely. The ADA demands it. And you mentioned at the beginning of this Q&A that there's the civil rights and legal precedent set, but holding to the law is different from having a law. And I think that is something that I'd be curious. I know there's several legal experts on the agenda, so I'd be curious what their thoughts are on how you can use the law to upstand, like to uphold that
And there's also a question about the definition of the term ableism.
Sorry, I didn't see. Okay.
Oh. Since you're using the word ableism so much, can you give your definition of the term?
Yes. So ableism is another word, what I thought consider synonymous for discrimination because of disability. So it's like racism, discrimination because of race. Ableism is discrimination because of a person's disability. And it's really the privileging of able bodies over disabled patients with disability that brings that term ableism.
Yeah.
If that answers the question.
John, do you have
I think I have an ableism in the, I think I put that in the syllabus. So that definition that I consider, there's a lot of different definitions that you can look at, but that's how I view it.
So I want to thank both of you for just a wonderful presentation and conversation. I think, you know, some of us are a little bit stunned because, or actually depressed maybe, or overwhelmed. And so I wanted to just ask some questions about some practical things, because it's so easy to say it's the system and, you know, we'll wait forever for the system to change, for us to change the system. But one of the things, methods, I suppose, that people have talked about is for practices, clinics, hospitals, as well as efforts in the community to have family advisory councils, you know, ways for families, for self-advocates to be included in basically anything, you know, including making changes. And I'm wondering if both of you have experiences with that in your practices or suggestions on how that can be done.
We have a family advisory council at our children's hospital. And I find every time I'm doing a new research or I do a lot of quality improvement work as well, I bring it to them to get feedback, because sort of back to the comments earlier about lived experience, if you're going to make a change or study something about someone else's health, it's critical to have their input on it. And so I found the Family Advisory Council at our institution to be very useful and very helpful in providing their perspective, and not just one person's perspective, but a large group of families who have experience in the healthcare system to drive our work.
I'm going to add a couple of things to that. The first is that I've long worked with family advocacy and support groups, both locally and nationally, groups like Family Voices. And the practices of how to utilize families as leaders has really super advanced over the last 30 years. And I would encourage collaboration to be able to ensure that families as leaders are not, you know, families as hanging out in the room while everybody else talks. The other is that there are now standards. When we're talking about what do we do, there are a lot more tools and a lot more, you know, options available to be able to address this work than there were even 20 to 50 years ago. And I would advise thinking about the compensation necessary. So in my own group here, Developmental Behavior Pediatrics, we employ family navigators, and we have families that have come through our system and are now employed with us as staff who started as family navigators. You have to put your money where, you know, where your values are. And I have absolutely, I am absolutely sticking to that as part of our budget. It's just built into our budget.
So I'm glad that you mentioned about the money aspect, because, you know, even, you know, with, you know, some people have suggested making sure that practices have social workers to help with certain needs. And I've gotten some pushback that, you know, that costs money. Where do we find the money to do this? And as you have mentioned, the way that our payment system is, it doesn't necessarily easily pay for those types of activities. Maybe if you can talk a little bit more about how we can find sources of support elsewhere if our institutions aren't willing to address this.
Yeah, it is. I'm going to give a high level answer, because, you know, every institution is going to be different in there. I mean, I think it's fair to say that fee for service in a practice is not going to pay for a social worker. That's just that just doesn't happen. Alternative payment models can help pay for it. Some places work with funding, external funding. Some of it's built into, those resources are built into fairly qualified health centers. If you're working in a large organization, you have to lobby for it as part of a funds flow model that comes in for places that actually do have bring enough of revenue to be able to cover an entire system. I always advocate for, like, make sure that you keep data, make sure you document. The way we're justifying your family navigators is that, like, we know that they had like two people working a total of 20 hours a week, had 2,600 individual encounters in the last year. And you have to keep data and you have to advocate and you have to make sure that our administrative colleagues understand the value all the way around, as well as appealing to the values and principles of your institution.
Thanks. Thank you. I have a sort of a separate question about something very specific. So I think, Stephanie, you had talked about sometimes there are procedures that we use in our clinics, such as appointment systems, that don't allow for a full discussion about issues that may come up, especially for children and youth with medical complexity. I'm wondering if you might have suggestions on how to change that, in the sense that I think our systems are built so that even healthcare providers get penalized for spending too much time with our patients. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but oftentimes when I was practicing, I've had staff basically tell me that they're leaving now because it's 5 o'clock, so things like that can sort of add pressure to clinicians to truncate our visits. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that. So my immediate answer is that
I got a lot.
Sometimes we're trying our best and it's a workaround. The system doesn't work. But at the same time, we may be complicit because we know maybe some of the things that we should be doing, but we don't share that with other team members in our practices. Part of the systems change is really to think about all the different people who are involved in the care, and to understand where all of us are first coming from, and then begin to sort of take a sort of a very large team approach. But anyway,
I just wanted to say I'm not the expert on outpatient timing, but a couple comments to follow up. So when in our study, the discrimination families felt wasn't just the clinician or the provider. It was also coming from the person who checked them in, the person who answers the phones, the person who takes their vitals and tries to get their weight. Those are people that may be overlooked in the implicit bias training that happens in medical school or other, and those providers also need to recognize their conversations and attitudes and have that type of training as well. And then I have one more point, but I forgot it. So I'm going to let Dennis speak.
Okay. John, I could go on all day about clinic flow. I think that to build on something that Stephanie had said, I have two specifics to it. The first is that with lived experiences and really just taking that journey through the clinic, you'd be able to stitch the whole thing together. In the institutions I've worked at, when I was in private practice, everybody reported up to the same person. In the institutions I've worked at, including large hospitals and medical schools, they reported up to different people. They had no idea what was going on the other side of the wall. And so there were things that when you get into nitty gritty of things like, you have to make sure that if you open your clinic at 8 o'clock in the morning and you've got four providers and you've got five room and you've got five patients, you have to have more than one person checking in a patient, right? And these are things that you don't necessarily get into until you bring everybody together and just look at, okay, what's it like for somebody to come in and journey through the clinic and how would you like to be treated? I think that lens of lived experience as a design really can apply to the whole thing, because I will even make sure that folks know, Like, how do you manage to flow through a patient's visit? And a lot of times I'll get the answer of, well, that's like when they check in. My answer is no, it's actually when the person is born and has it, you know, is there. And we're trying to make sure that they know that organization stands to support lived experiences, anti-ableism and social justice. And so when you know that, then you will start to do things like how we communicate outside of the clinic, how we reach out before and after, your appointment system, because all of that's going to build into your flow. Like, if you want to talk about flow, you've actually got to talk about the values of how the system interacts with, like, things like how do you make appointments.
Thank you. And I have one last question, I think, Stephanie, you had raised this, which is the legal partners. And Dennis, you know, there are rules and regulations, and I suspect that we don't follow them. I don't know what we do, but we're definitely not following the words of, the ADA, et cetera. I'm wondering if there's been any precedents in terms of legal actions or some type of certification systems or something to sort of force the change, because it's been so slow in coming. And what do you think about that? I know that's like a sort of a big reactive way to address this.
I think that's a great question, and I am not sure I have a great answer for you, but I do think that, you know, there is a lot of discussion and talk about how there's the law and upholding the law are two separate things, and how you can merge those would be an area to explore. I don't know any, I mean, I'm sure there are, but I'm not know off the top of my head of legal precedents, but I think that's where it becomes very important to ask your parents or your families or your patients what barriers they face to get into the clinic, to understand it, sort of as Dennis was saying, from starting the lived experience of how it was designed, to understand, and then know that the law requires you as a physician or healthcare system to provide reasonable accommodations. That's part of the law. But how to make it upheld is a different question.
Yeah. And I think that on top of that, there are places that there are ways to do disability audits, for example. And I think that said, I also think that just being aware, I think there's a lot of this may also just not, it's awareness. Like, for example, we have an adult changing table. We have an adult size changing table in one of our bathrooms in the clinic. There's, like, when looking at universal design principles, human-centered design principles, walking through spaces with lived experience partners and leaders, really, they're leaders. Again, you have to pay for their time, pay for their expertise. These things come out. And John, you mentioned about, like, if you go back to the system, I mean, you could really use the same thing with facilities. When facilities need to be renovated, these are excellent times to bring these things up. But, you know, you do have to make questions, decisions about how to be able to do things like when you renovate. But a lot of it's awareness. And I think that conversations like this and knowing that, yes, you do have to know the law, you do have to use the tools, and there are processes. I really think one of the biggest things that we've done in the last 30 years is that there were even more processes now to make sure that we can address these with tools and through design, through lived experience leaders. I mean, there are tools to be able to address this and be able to put this on the radar so that we can address them.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.